You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 27th of March 2023 on Monocle Radio.
Israel on the brink, but of what exactly? Scotland learns who its new leader is, and is nothing really the best use of an abandoned airport? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Tessa Shishkovitz and Bill Hayton, will discuss all the day's big stories. We'll have the latest from Israel, and we'll speak to the historian Katja Hoyer about her new book, which recalls the vanished state of East Germany beyond its Trabant-powered cliches. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Tessa Shishkovitz, journalist and author and UK correspondent for Falter magazine, and by Bill Hayton, associate fellow for the Asia-Pacific programme at Chatham House. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
As is traditional, in the light introductory banter part of the programme, we are going to ask the guests where they have been recently. Bill, you have been in Taiwan.
I've been in Taiwan. I've been discussing the future of East Asia. It's all going to be fine, don't worry.
Oh, was it all going to be fine anyway and they brought you over to tell you that, or did you go over there and basically sort it all out?
It would be nice to think it was the latter, but I think kind of everybody knows that it will be quite a big deal if things change, and so therefore they'll kind of just keep things, you know, turning over.
Would you recommend, and this is a leading question from the presenter who went to Taiwan in about, I think, 2005 or 6 and frankly enjoyed it enormously, would you recommend to people that despite everything they visit?
Yeah, food is great, people are great.
Also true.
History is great, environment is great. If just don't go on an official delegation where all you see is the inside of offices for 4 days and then go home.
this program clearly basically brought to you by the Taiwan Tourist Authority. It absolutely isn't, just to be clear. That's Bill and I speaking out of genuine enthusiasm, and a big hello to all our listeners in Taiwan. And a big hello to all our listeners in Austria as well, Tessa, where I'm sure we have many, and where you have recently been visiting, which is possibly less remarkable than Bill going to Taiwan because that's where you're from.
Yeah, and I'm, first of all, that, and I'm also not working for the Austrian Tourist office, because I have to say that I was there to enjoy some springtime with my parents, and then it turned into springtime for Hitler, because the lower Austrian government again went into a coalition with the far right, and with a very far right, with a really nasty part of this Freedom Party, and so it was a little bit overshadowed our spring.
There was a time when we used to get quite excited about Austrian parties doing deals with the far right, and now it's just meh, you know, another one.
You see, this is a sad truth. It's not a kind of taboo that they are breaking. It starts to be a tradition that the Conservative Party does these coalitions.
Well, on the subject, however, of parties doing deals with the far right, we are going to start in Israel, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is addressing the nation more or less right now, which is mightily inconvenient of him. But we will be going to Jerusalem for an update later in the show. So far today, however, Netanyahu appears to have backed down a bit after a fashion, but protesters also appear to have noticed that he has only backed down a bit after a fashion. One of Netanyahu's hard-right allies, Itamar Ben-Gvir, leader of the Jewish Power Party, has said that the controversial proposed judicial reforms will be punted to the next parliamentary session, in exchange for which, discouragingly, a National Guard will be formed under the oversight of the National Security Ministry, current proprietor Itamar Ben-Gvir. Bill, what could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong with a militia led by a man with overtly sectarian inclinations, which is separate from the Defence Ministry, and a man who has a track record of supporting, you know, far-right figures who've killed Arabs in the past? So it does look really rather grim.
It really does, because, Tessa, it's very hard to know where Netanyahu thinks this is going to lead. He is clearly trying to cling on to power for various reasons, but he is doing that now with the assistance of people such as Mr. Ben-Gvir, who give every indication of being quite seriously unhinged.
Well, they're not only unhinged. I mean, they have a clear far-right racist agenda, which is ethnically and religiously based. I mean, it's really the worst of all possibilities. And they're in government. the question is, how long will they be in government? And what I have to say, I'm really impressed with the liberal democratic Israelis that are having such a stamina now to go to the streets. And it's built up for weeks now, and it affects the sectors of the society that Netanyahu can really not work without. So we have people from the military, the reservists, who say they are not coming back to the service if this government continues to dismantle the independence judges and courts. And the other part that he can't live without is the high-tech sector, which really makes the Israeli economy thrive. And so, and they are also very closely connected. And a lot of these people who are now on the street spent years in the army defending Israel's interests, whatever you might think about this. But it is a very, very important moment in the Israeli history. Just to for the 75th birthday, they are now having a little civil war, but one that was sort of really, it's really important that we watch this closely, because it might also change the course of, you know, they might win this battle and this reform might be so stalled for long enough to push this government out of government and then have new elections.
But also this reform might not be stalled. And Bill, we do have to bear in mind that it might also be more popular than the current demonstrations are making it look, because whenever there are huge demonstrations, the media quite reasonably gets attracted to the huge demonstrations because it's a huge thing. And these demonstrations, to be clear, as a percentage of Israel's population, are absolutely enormous. Nevertheless, most Israelis are not demonstrating. Is Netanyahu betting on what Nixon might have referred to as the silent majority, and is he right?
I mean, it seems here you've got these two tensions between the liberal and the democratic. I mean, so you have this liberal group that wants to defend the institutions, the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, etc., the independence of the military. But they are now clinging on to those institutions as guarantors of Israel's previous history as a liberal democratic society. And yet, at the same time, there's a democratic majority pushing Israel the other way, and which is only going to get, more entrenched, because the supporters of that part of Israeli society are having more babies ultimately, and so there is increasingly a demographic majority in favour of this, you know, rightward swing in Israeli politics. And so I think there's a sense that this is why it's so desperate, is that there's this part of the Israeli population, this more liberal left part, kind of feels that it's losing the state, you know, that kind of tradition of that sort of leftist Zionism is being kind of overtaken by the right wing kind.
Tessa, you I believe have just come from the answering protest here in London, or the echoing protest, I suspect I should say. What sense did you get of what the people at that actually want? Do they want Netanyahu to call yet another election? Do they just want him not to do this judicial reform? Was there a coherent, I guess, counter-proposal?
Well, I think at the moment the most important is to stop or stall this reform. But it has spun out of control now already. So people are, of course, all these people who go to these demonstrations, they don't want Netanyahu, who is a corrupt, long-term prime minister who has three trials to go through if he has a proper justice minister who would allow them. So we are talking really about a deeply, deeply sensitive moment in Israeli history. And all those now on Parliament Square that were demonstrating now, you saw also, which is maybe also a bit more a London scheme, some posters were democracy for all with Palestinian flags. So I think in Israel itself, you see big demonstration for Israeli democracy, which does not necessarily mention the Palestinian issue. But here, because the political situation here and the sensitivity is a little bit different, I think people would also like to combine these protests with asking for justice for the Palestinians too.
Well, I do hope we will be coming back to this later in the show, when we will be speaking to somebody with a bit of luck in Jerusalem who is listening to what Netanyahu is saying right now. But before we move on, just finally on this, Tessa, you are, I believe, hoping to go to Israel very, very shortly. How do you like your chances of actually getting there?
Well, at the moment, we were discussing today, so today the airport is closed. It's a strike day, and more people are joining it, and so also the airport is closed. For Israel to have the Tel Aviv airport closed is a really big thing, because that's the only way in and out, basically, for normal people who go and come and go into Israel. And so I expect it to be open next week when we were supposed to go. And we will see if we have Passover and Easter weekend in Israel, because it's also a very sensitive moment. You might remember that some of these far-right extremist ministers planned to go to the Haram al-Sharif, also known as the Temple Mount, to slaughter a sheep there in order to provoke more tension. So I think there's enough tension at the moment as it is, so maybe he might step back from these plans, but we will see. It might be really a complicated week next week in Jerusalem.
Indeed so. Well, as I said, more on that hopefully later in the show. But to Scotland now, where the governing Scottish National Party has a new leader, and so therefore will Scotland, unless something deeply peculiar occurs between now and Scotland's Parliament sitting tomorrow. Scotland's presumptive new First Minister is Humza Yousaf, who was first elected to Scotland's Parliament in 2011 and has previously served as Cabinet Secretary for Health and for Justice. He has a tough act to follow in outgoing First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, who dominated Scottish politics for years, if without ever realising her driving ambition of Scottish independence. Speaking after his election by the SNP earlier, Humza Yousaf promised, as people in his position always do, to heal divisions.
To those in Scotland who don't yet quite share that passion that I do for independence, I will aim to earn your trust by continuing to ensure we govern well and earn your respect as First Minister by focusing on the priorities that matter to all of us. And in doing so, using our devolved powers to the absolute maximum effect to tackle the challenges of the day. And for those of us in this room and watching who do believe in independence, we will only win by making that case on the doorsteps. And my solemn promise and commitment to you is that I will kickstart our grassroots, our civic-led movement, and ensure our drive for independence is in fifth gear. The people of Scotland need independence now more than ever before, and we will be the generation that delivers independence for Scotland.
Or will they? Bill, the key dream there of the SNP, Scottish independence, do you get the sense that it is a ship that might have sailed? The latest YouGov poll has 39 for yes, 47 for no. And though Yousaf is promising a new referendum, he must know that if this is tried and fails again, that's it for decades, generations.
I think so. And this isn't a one-off poll. I mean, this is the trend ever since the referendum. It's 2014, wasn't it? And so, the numbers have dropped off. Although there's a substantial numbers of don't knows, which in theory, you know, might switch and make a majority kind of come the day. But, you know, I think that the travails of the SNP-led government has made people realise that, you know, the problem with an independence referendum is, you know, the government wins. You know, kind of, just depends which government it is. And governments have failings. And so, the idea that the SNP was going to lead Scotland into this great new future has run into the reality of problems with the health service and transport and all the usual things that, that governments have. Hence, this desire to, pick a fight, it seems, over this, you know, what to many people outside the UK might seem as this rather obscure question of gender recognition, and to kind of use that as a lever to sort of kind of amplify the idea that the UK government is going to force Scotland down a particular path and override its own legislation on this question. But it does seem, you know, that was the issue that ultimately led to the downfall of Nicola Sturgeon. Doesn't seem to play well with the majority of the Scottish population. And so that might end up actually, you know, being a big, you know, nothing for Humza Yousaf.
Tessa, on this question of declining support for independence, is there a somewhat ironic argument that it has actually been killed by Brexit? Because definitely immediately after Brexit, Nicola Sturgeon sensed a new opportunity, because obviously Scotland voted decisively to stay in the EU, whereas it was England and via very tiny majority Wales which voted to leave. You know, she appeared the morning after the referendum on television, flanked by the Scottish British and the European flags. She thought the circumstances had changed that would justify another referendum. But is the problem now that Scots realise that there would need to be a hard border between Scotland and England, which would be economically calamitous?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit too much for many, many Scots to think that not only did they lose the EU, now they are losing England if they would go out of the United Kingdom. It was just too much in too many years to digest. And now plus such a cost of living crisis, you know, Scotland is a poor country. The insecurity of going to an independent route and not being so sure how many years it would take to negotiate the exit from the United Kingdom and the entry to the European Union, and all this while their leaders don't seem to have their act together and have to be replaced quite frequently. I think it's really not the best time now to think about this, a second independent referendum, which they are not allowed to do in any case. So I think we are seeing the drive for independence maybe leaving with Nicola Sturgeon for the moment, at least. You know, it can change, but Brexit is one factor in it. The other factor is you have you had a really crazy Tory government, Brexit government here. Now you still have a very conservative government, which people are not so fond of in Scotland. And now the question is if next year, or, you know, beginning of 25, a Labour government wins the elections here, it will be even harder for a Scottish government of the SNP to start independence proceedings, because a lot of people will think like maybe it will be a more humane United Kingdom coming up with Keir Starmer as Prime Minister.
Well, indeed so. I mean, that will be a big test, the next UK election, Bill. I mean, there have been some possibly somewhat fanciful projections suggesting that in the event of a complete meltdown of the Conservative vote, the Scottish National Party could end up actually being His Majesty's loyal opposition, which would be moderately hilarious. But that will be one electoral test for the SNP. The next one, the big one, i.e. in Scotland, is not actually due until 2026. In that interregnum, is there a way back for Labour and Conservative in Scotland, in Scottish politics? The current Scottish Parliament has the SNP on 64 of the 129 seats versus 31 for the Tories and 22 for Labour.
Yes, I think so. But before you do that, let's just, you know, note the remarkable fact that we now have a Hindu Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and a Muslim First Minister of Scotland. And this is seen as entirely normal and unremarkable in British discussions.
A Taoiseach of the Republic of Ireland of Indian descent as well.
Yes, yes. And so, and, you know, I guess as long as he, you know, genuflects to the king and all the rest of it, you know, all will be well. It's not a remarkable thing. But I think in many countries it would be considered very remarkable. But yes, I think, you know, what we've got now in Scotland is something approaching kind of normal politics, if you like, when people argue over the health service and the transport system and all the normal stuff of government. And the independence question has declined in importance. And that therefore means that, you know, unionist parties broadly, meaning Labour and the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, stand more of a chance of winning back some ground against the SNP, because they'll be arguing over things which they can make a strong case for on those questions of governance.
And Tessa, it's something you alluded to earlier, the fact that we now have a government in the United Kingdom possibly less abrasive to a lot of people in Scotland, because if you were going to construct, I think, the kind of British Prime Minister who would be most calculated to irritate Scottish sentiment, you would come up with somebody more or less exactly like Boris Johnson, and possibly narrowly in front of someone almost exactly like David Cameron. Is there an opportunity there for the government in Westminster to make the case for the union to Scotland, or is this still a thing where the way that they can best make the case is just by not making the case?
Well, I would have always wished that England, as the strongest nation, would show the smaller nations the appreciation of having this union. I mean, it just never happened. That's why the first independent vote got suddenly so heated and close. Yeah? But, you know, if you look at the Westminster government now, and you have mostly things like an illegal migration bill, which already in its wording is outrageously inhumane. That seems to be what they are focusing on. They're not focusing on union and shared interests and all these kind of things. So I think for this Tory government, it's more or less lost to make this case. There's also not enough time left. I mean, they're busy trying to have Northern Ireland now relatively calm enough to get Joe Biden to come here in April. So Scotland is maybe also not on the first. And they can watch, you know, sitting in the first row, how the leadership in Edinburgh is not really, you know, they're getting their act together now, but they are not very dynamic at the moment. They are not a big, you know, opponent for big things now. So I think they will just sit it out for the moment.
Well, let's move along. Today, March 27th, is Armed Forces Day in Myanmar. Information which might well prompt the question as to which day under the current settlement isn't Armed Forces Day in Myanmar. General Min Aung Hlaing, the officer currently adorned with more gold braid than any of the rest of the ruling junta, marked the occasion by reviewing a parade of military vehicles through the wide streets of Naypyidaw, followed by a speech in which he pledged the crushing of Myanmar's foes, not pausing to grapple with the difficulty that most of those he perceives as Myanmar's foes are actually Myanmarese. Bill, do we basically have to resign ourselves to the idea that the junta, for all their chat about free and fair elections once the state of emergency ends, etc., is there to stay?
That, unfortunately, is my feeling. I mean, my grounds for saying this is I spent a year in Myanmar trying to turn its state broadcaster into a liberal democratic institution and obviously didn't do very well. So I kind of watched the military function kind of fairly close up. And they believe that they are the soul and the spine of the nation and that what they say defines the limits of the nation and that anybody who opposes them is, a traitor or just misguided. And so kind of questions about, what's good for the country as a whole can be answered by basically what's good for the military. And so therefore, kind of the idea that there's a different point of view out there just doesn't kind of compute with them. So I think they live in their kind of isolated cantons in this crazy city in Naypyidaw. They're cut off from the outside world. They watch their own media and television. And they kind of, have a view of the world where if only they remain strong and, then the country remains strong. They have no truck with any idea of dissolving their power with sort of moves towards federalism to accommodate the ethnic minorities, all the rest of it. And I think that they will, they will fight it out. And as much as I would, love to see, a democratic federalist, post-military Burma, emerge, you've just got this massive roadblock of the military sitting in the way. And I think we'll, the situation will get worse and worse and worse. But eventually, maybe in a decade's time, there's going to have to be, some solution that involves talking to the military.
Tessa, what Bill is describing there is Myanmar, regrettably, as we have largely known it over recent decades. The difference being, if you think back a while, is that there was an opposition figurehead, an extremely formidable and admired opposition figurehead in Aung San Suu Kyi. She is no longer, I think it's fair to say, widely perceived as this secular saint akin to Nelson Mandela et al. She is in prison. She's 77. It's probably pretty unlikely she'll ever be released. Absent her as a focus, is there actually any international sympathy anymore for those contesting the Myanmarese junta?
I mean, because of Aung San Suu Kyi also having lost this opposition image while she was sort of at least officially in power, even when she was very much under pressure always by the military. But I think that's why everyone is looking quite skeptical now at who's coming up and if they would be a nice government for their minorities or if they would sort of be looking at that quite critically too. But at the moment, I think, if a regime declares its opposition parties and groups as terrorists, there's not much they can do because that allows a military regime to crush them. And it's very hard to form a democratic movement on the streets or also in institutions when your label is terrorist. And that's why I think we will have to see how this continues. And as you say, Bill, it sort of will probably take a few years. And I remember I interviewed Aung San Suu Kyi in the 90s when she was under house arrest. And she was really this, as you described her, this figure of a saintly figure of, you know, pacifistic resistance and sitting there in her house and speaking to the people over the wall. And it was wonderful. But these things are not enough, and these legends cannot last under these circumstances, unfortunately.
And Bill, we spoke a bit earlier in the context of Israel about the silent majority, the people who aren't rebelling, the people who aren't protesting. And I was struck by some of the general speech today, in which he did talk a bit like somebody trying to rouse up a base. He banged on about the legacies of British imperialism and Japanese occupation, etc., etc. Is there a constituency that flies with? Are there people who actually aren't all that unhappy about, you know, military rule in Myanmar?
I think what we're looking at is a kind of resigned population. There's a sense, I mean, just look at the election results. I mean, I think the military had no idea in 2015 just quite how unpopular they were when the democratic elections were held, and then again in 2020. They just can't bring themselves to understand that they are not the saviors of the nation. And yet, clearly, the results show that despite, you know, the years of house arrest and the suppression of the opposition, all the rest of it, that the opposition is broad-based and has a huge support. Yet, ultimately, it comes down to a question of physical power on the streets. And, you know, for people who are just trying to make a living in Yangon or Mandalay or the other cities, you know, that's the reality. So they'll, you know, they don't see a way to overthrow the military. I think, you know, gestures here and there, the odd bomb attack, you know, assassination, and an ambush of a military convoy here and there. But at the moment, it doesn't amount to a wholesale revolution.
Well, let's take a look now at something altogether less dramatic, essentially at a story at which nothing has happened for 15 years, which is Berlin's Tempelhof Airport. And it was 15 years ago that the last flights took off. In the 15 years since, the vast space has been left to the weeds, the rust, and one might whimsically imagine the ghosts of an extraordinary history. This Nazi-built facility, which became Berlin's Cold War lifeline, then one of Europe's best-loved commercial airports. There is now a renewed push to do something more useful with this huge uninhabited space in the middle of a city struggling to find somewhere to put all its citizens. It is likely that Berlin's incoming city government will plough ahead with plans to plant the runways with apartment blocks. Tessa, is there any good reason not to do this?
No, I think Berlin, it has so many big problems. And to have Tempelhof not being developed, of course, would be just a lost opportunity. What is quite funny is that what they are proposing now is totally reasonable. You know, just make apartments many and have a lot of green space in between that could all work out. But there were a lot of really...
I mean, that does sound pretty reasonable when you put it like that.
Well, no, I mean, it's totally fine. There were other ideas that they had, which could have been much more fun for us, you know, coming there as tourists. For example, to put out a Mount Tempelhof, a magic mountain in the center of Berlin, because Berlin is super flat. So they could have had some fun doing that. But you remember that here in London, our mount at the
Marble Arch heap
was not a big success and really expensive. So I don't think that this will be recycled. But there were other ideas to, you know, to make a lake and all this. But Berlin has a lot of lakes, so they didn't need to do that.
It's got a lot of really nice parks as well.
Yeah, but you really need a lot of apartments, and they should be in a modern concept of, you know, for kids' playgrounds and parks and shady squares and all this kind of thing. So.
Because, Bill, it strikes me that if what people are concerned about is erasing the extraordinary history of Tempelhof Airport, it surely should not be beyond the wit of people, and of all people, not beyond the wit of Germans, to come up with something that does both provide an actually useful and used urban space while yet acknowledging what once occurred here.
Well, it is quite a big place, isn't
it? It's huge. It's an airport. It's enormous.
So there must be some space for different activities, you'd have thought. I mean, and the politics of this, you know, are going to be fascinating. So if, as the reports are to be believed, it's the centre-right and the centre-left kind of getting together and having a sort of tacit agreement, and this is going to be opposed by the Greens and the far-left, well, you know, kind of who are the base of those parties? I mean, are they supported by the people who need, you know, cheap apartments and some kind of reduction in property prices, or are these the people that already have somewhere nice to live and they're, you know, and therefore their priorities are on sort of green open space and all the rest of it? So I mean, it's you look at the way that these kind of prime city centre locations have been used in other places. I mean, if you go to Manila, for example, if you go to Makati, you kind of realise there's something weird about the street arrangements there. That's because it was the old airbase, you know, for the city, and the control tower is still sitting in the middle of the park there, and yet all the kind of surrounding area has been turned into, in Manila's case, I mean, these are very fancy apartments, it's true, but old, you know, kind of army bases that have been, you know, repurposed. Or do you go the Christiania, you know, direction in Copenhagen, you know, where you kind of preserve it as a sort of, you know, a naturified sort of old, you know, military fortification with a kind of slight hippie and drug dealing edge to it.
Because Tessa, it is that would be a tough pitch to put to the citizens. We will include hippies and drug dealers. Tessa, it is possible to do these things well. I mean, here in London, I'm not going to pass judgment on Battersea Power Station because I have not yet been there, but I lived here long enough, I can remember when the Tate Modern was, or what is now the Tate Modern, was a ruin. It was just this abandoned hulk that was left in this prime spot on the south bank of the Thames, and now it's fantastic.
Yeah, thanks to a few oligarchs who put a lot of money in there. But it really is a success story, because it's a museum that is, you can enter without paying any fees. It's only for special exhibitions where you have to pay, so it really serves has a very good thing to do for the public here and for tourists also. And the Battersea Power Station is a bit of a, you know, that was really a huge, monstrous project, but it also created a new district where there was none at the time, you know. And I went recently there on an east-west architecture tour and had a look at it, and I think it's a quite successful thing that they did there, with all this also, you know, movie theaters, and you know, it just creates new life also in a part of a city, so that's quite good. I mean, there are similar projects like this all over the world. In Vienna, they converted the gas storage gasometers in the city, in the center of Vienna, also into apartments for affordable living, and including cinema and shops and restaurants and all this. I think this is quite good. But, you know, even the little red telephone booth thingies that are standing around and that are sometimes now coffee shops, or I saw one that was converted into an aquarium. So I think you can go from the biggest to the smallest projects and just recycle architecture in our cities.
Tessa Shishkovitz and Bill Hayton, thank you both for joining us. Now, we will be going back to our main story this evening, which is the crisis in Israel. As we said at the top of the show, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has just been speaking to the nation. Among those listening was Amy Spiro, a journalist with the Times of Israel. She joins us from Jerusalem. Amy, basically, what did Netanyahu have to say?
Sure. The main headline from Netanyahu's speech is certainly that he is pausing for the moment this legislation. He said it's not going to pass in the coming week before the Knesset, the parliament, goes on break for Passover. And he said we want to use this time to hold negotiations, hold talks with the opposition, come to a wide agreement, and then bring it back once again in about a month when the Knesset does return.
Do you get the sense that that is going to persuade any of the extraordinary numbers of people protesting to go home?
Yeah, so we've seen already reactions, right after his speech. So, the main labor union that called for a general strike this morning did say that they will end the strike and that tomorrow things will go back to normal. But the leaders of the protests certainly still intend to keep going. You know, while Netanyahu did say he wants to reach a wide agreement and he wants to avoid civil war and he wants us to all really get along, he did make it very clear that he fully intends to still pursue this legislation and still put some version of it forward in the future. We just really don't know what that version will look like.
Have we heard any more about this idea that was floated of some sort of National Guard under the command of Itamar Ben-Gvir?
Yeah, you know, listening to Netanyahu's speech, it's almost interesting to hear what he didn't say is what he did say. So there was no mention of Ben-Gvir. There was no mention of a National Guard. There's also no mention of his fired defense minister that sort of kicked off this real round of protests and riots and demonstrations. So he did not bring it up. You know, we know he has been in meetings all day with advisors, with confidants, with aides. We don't know exactly, obviously, what was said during those meetings. All we have is the speech he gave tonight. You know, which didn't mention most of those things. So there are a lot of questions moving forward.
I mean, does that, those things he didn't say, seem to confirm an impression that he does find himself in the position of attempting to govern with a coalition of allies who he really can't stand?
You know, I mean, this government is, as we've heard, you know, the most right-wing religious government we've had. Netanyahu, you know, he's been in power. Obviously, he was out of power for about a year, but he's been in power for so long, and he's had so many different coalitions. And I think what we've seen above all is that he wants the coalition that's going to keep him in that seat. And right now, this is basically the only one that's possible for him to lead. So he has had opportunities to get rid of some of the people that maybe he doesn't want to work with, but he's not, right? We've seen, I mean, Ben-Gvir, like you mentioned, this National Guard. So Netanyahu did not mention it in his speech, but Ben-Gvir showed to the public and showed to the media a letter signed by Netanyahu promising it to him. So he gave in to that demand. So he has clearly, you know, doing things that maybe he does find distasteful, but it's not stopping him in any way.
Amy Spiro with the Times of Israel in Jerusalem. Thank you for joining us. Finally, on today's show, the collapse of European communism in the late 80s and early 90s caused a dramatic redrawing of maps. As Yugoslavia fractured, several of the Soviet Union's reluctant constituents escaped, and Czechoslovakia split. East Germany, however, disappeared entirely, subsumed into the structures of West Germany. East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, had existed since 1949. While it was clearly in many respects imperfect, it would not have had to put up a wall to stop people leaving otherwise, it was nevertheless a place people called home, for better and for worse. The historian Katja Hoyer has spoken to many of those people for her new book, Beyond the Wall, East Germany 1949 to 1990. I spoke to Katja earlier and began by asking her about her own childhood in the GDR and if she ever still feels more East German than German.
I think it's a bit of both. It's a strange thing because in many ways, you know, you grow up in the shadows or in the remnants of a country that doesn't exist anymore. All the people that you know, your parents, your teachers, your neighbours, you know, all talk about this thing that doesn't exist anymore and come with kind of legacy and baggage from that. So in many ways, I would say there is still an East German identity there, also amongst generations that were actually born after the war. Had completely disappeared because the legacy persists, so a cultural, political and economic legacy from the country, even though it's not there anymore.
Your book is a fairly comprehensive history of East Germany, and it is told through the experiences of people who grew up there and lived there and had all kinds of different lives within East Germany. And as such, I guess it ends up being a rebuke to the stereotype people think of, I guess, a slightly beleaguered, drably dressed bunch of people driving Trabants while being spied on by the Stasi. But there's obviously a lot more to it than that. What does the stereotyped idea of East Germany miss?
I think just the complexity of life, this idea that people spent, you know, 41 years in a kind of walled off Russian colony just waiting for liberation, just turns them into like this grey, faceless mass of victims, effectively. Mm. And I think this idea that they had, you know, political ideals that they were trying to pursue one way or another, they were opposition people, but also people who genuinely believed in the idea of a socialist state. You had the vast majority of people leading fairly apolitical lives and kind of just getting on with it, if you will. Writing, you know, creating music, creating art, going on holiday, making jokes, you know, all of this kind of just life, really, and culture that was almost swept away or destroyed with the destruction of the country is, I think, worth highlighting and worth talking about as something more than just oppression.
When you talk to the people that you talk to for the book, and not just them, when you talk to people, your family, your friends, people you've known who have larger amounts of their lives rooted in those memories, do they talk about aspects of it still with fondness or suggest that there are things that East Germany did perhaps even better than West Germany did?
I think the two things get conflated quite a lot. I think there's, on the one side, one's kind of private life. So it's quite possible to remember, I don't know, East German Coke, say, for example. There was Vita Cola, you know, which is still a popular brand now. And it tastes just different and people are, you know, fond of these kind of just normal memories, like your own life, things like smells, feelings, emotions, experiences that one had as part of the life in the GDR, but not necessarily directly connected to its politics. And then on the other side, as you say, there are people who also miss certain aspects of life in the GDR. So this can be, for instance, the sense that there was a work collective. At work, you were part of a team, of a brigade, as they were called. And that made for really close work relationships. People would be in the same workplace for, you know, the entire career often, forging very close bonds with the people that they were working with. And that, many people feel, has now been lost. And I think remembering those things one way or another doesn't necessarily entail wanting the regime back or trying to sort of go down a route of relativizing it. I think those two are very separate things, kind of one's own memories and the memories of the state.
Do you still find, though, that there is a different mentality of any kind? You've mentioned this already in this interview, that there are still all sorts of East-West divides in Germany. This is a point you make in the book as well, that you still see this in the different politics in both sides of the country, in different industries, in different cultural strains. But do you find still that East Germans think differently about things in any significant respect?
I think they do, and most kind of surveys and studies show that as well. I mean, it is often hard to pin down or grasp because it's kind of pervasive cultural elements there that just carry on. So one example that springs to mind is that people had their children a lot younger, at a younger age. So my parents, for example, were in their early 20s when I was born. My mother was at university when she had me, which now seems kind of, you know, impossible to think about, you know, having a small child as you go to lectures. But this then meant that generations were and are a lot shorter. So people will have very young parents, very young grandparents, will get to know their great-grandparents. And that in itself, you know, leads to different parenting styles, for example, because people are less experienced, aren't really quite an adult themselves yet in a way. You know, those kinds of things collectively all make for quite a different society. And I think there's a legacy there that will long outlast the state and its existence. And it's worth talking about where that stuff comes from and what the impact is.
Did that mindset, though, end up having an impact on modern Germany, most obviously in the person of its long-serving Chancellor Angela Merkel? And I still kind of can't believe that nobody has made the film about one night in 1989 when there's this reasonably obscure physicist in Berlin and this equally obscure KGB major in Dresden sort of trying to understand what is occurring around them, neither, I'm sure, realizing that they will become two of the most powerful people on Earth.
Yeah, I think Angela Merkel is an interesting example in that she deliberately toned down her East Germanness for most of her career. She tried initially in the 90s to talk about it at various different points when people were asking her questions, and then realized very quickly that there is a huge political trap there. You know, people could find out things that she may have said when she was 16 or an essay that she might have had to write for her university degree, and then go back and find those sort of phrases where, I don't know, she might have been praising Marxism or something. So she toned it down quite a lot and didn't make a thing out of it, to the point where her very last sort of German unity day as a public holiday in Germany in office in 2021 was kind of the first time really where she openly addressed the fact that as an East German, she still feels now she can't really talk about being an East German because these kind of experiences have a political angle to it that is often difficult to avoid. So in many ways, she is perhaps the best known East German, but not for being an East German, actually for having kind of adapted to Western political culture very quickly.
You do refer to it in the book, which would be one of the other most famous representations of East Germany, which was the film, you know, Goodbye Lenin, which is a very, very funny film and a very well pulled off conceit. But is there still I guess, a slight nervousness about any public expression of affection for East Germany.
I think there is, and the film pulled it off quite cleverly in that basically it made it seem a silly thing to try and hold on to these memories. And of course, unlike the protagonist's mother in the film, who doesn't know that East Germany has gone and this kind of ridiculous facade is upheld, most East Germans realized even in 1990 that something had gone, the state's gone, and they don't want it back. But what they don't want to throw out with that is their own life experience, their own memory. They should be able to remember, say, I don't know, their wedding in 1978 without having to say, oh, but this happened in a terrible dictatorship. And this is something I think that many Germans feel very uncomfortable about. So one example, if I may, was, for instance, the fact that women were actually given lots of opportunities in the state. So East Germany had the highest rate of female employment in the world, over 90% of women, so almost everybody in full-time employment, because childcare was there and it was encouraged. You can't say that without adding a great big but at the end and then say, actually, this is part of socialist ideology and so on and so forth, which if you're an individual woman and you're now being offered to, I don't know, go to university whilst your child's being looked after in a childcare facility or on campus, you know, all of these things, you can't mention that still without adding this great big but at the end and relativizing it, which makes people uncomfortable if you do that. And this, I think, will take a long time still before it becomes less of a sensitive issue.
Katja Hoyer, thank you for joining us. And Katja's book, Beyond the Wall, East Germany 1949-90, is published on the 6th of April and heartily recommended. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Tessa Shishkovitz and Bill Hayton. Today's show was produced by Lillian Fawcett and Emma Searle and researched by Andrei Nikolai Pamintuan. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.